Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms. It's Sunday, June 22nd, in the future year of 2014. Welcome to episode 77, oh my goodness, of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now. And my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go,
the RCR is a podcast about retro computing news by Retro Computing News. Wait, no, that makes no sense, but you know what I mean. You've been here before. It's episode 77. We talk about the old things. We like nostalgia. We like collecting. We like the bits that sometimes catch on fire when you turn them on. That's what we like. And it's not just me. Couldn't have a round table with just me. It would be a stool. No, I am joined by others to make the table wonderful. Three others, in fact, today. First up, over on the other end of this continent, there's Earl Evans. The man so nice they gave him the same initial twice. Hello, Earl.
Hello, Carrington. I'm living on the edge, the card edge.
At the edge of the country. Out where it rains.
Yes, it does, but it's not today. It's beautiful here.
Oh, nice. Also, from your country, and I believe now back in your country, is Paul Hagstrom. Hello, Paul.
Hello, all.
You were recently in my country, weren't you?
Yep.
We kicked you back out.
Paul, you invaded?
Just briefly.
A brief invasion. And speaking of being kicked out of countries, sometimes when you do that to enough people, you can found a whole new one. And the descendants of those would be Michael Mulhern. Hello, Michael.
Good morning, everybody.
Those country based on criminals jokes never get old, huh?
Well, doesn't worry me. My lot weren't on those boats.
No? They came in other boats?
No. For some godforsaken reason, my lot decided to come here.
Oof. Because they heard such good things about the snakes and the spiders and the billion things that can kill you.
The drop pears and the killer kangaroos.
Are there killer kangaroos?
I don't know, but we had a couple of wallabies come through our backyard yesterday morning. Not enough of them to keep the grass down, so we'll have to get out and mow soon.
The grass is getting too long. Unleash the wallabies.
That's awesome. That is awesome.
So today, as always, we've got an action-packed show for our eager listeners. We're going to talk about lots of news. We're going to have things people can buy for me. We can have other things that people can buy for me and all of that. But first up, we are, as usual, going to have a host topic. And oh, look, I'm the host, so I picked a topic. And the topic I have picked, I have entitled, Wherefore Art Thou, Retro? See, it's like a Shakespeare thing. Here's the question. Why bother? I mean, really, why bother to use or collect these things? In particular, why bother to use them? What is the big deal? Yes, there's the nostalgia factor, but let's put that aside. We all liked these things when we were kids. We all like them now, and there's a great element of nostalgia. But is there anything else? I was on eBay recently and noticed that to buy a really nice Apple IIe setup, like a complete one, will cost me more than it would, say, to go into Best Buy and buy a brand new PC. So when we've got the cost like this at this outrageous length, or at this outrageous height, length, width, something, costs have gotten outrageous, what I'm saying, in all three dimensions, why would one bother? I mean, what is there any sense in owning these things, in using them, or is it just nostalgia? So I'd like to see if there's any reason to your rhymes, fellows, and I thought we would go around the table and see what you have to say about this topic. So, why don't we start in, I guess, let's go in the same order that I introduced you, bozos. So we will start with Earl. Earl, answer me. Answer our listeners. I charge you with strangeness of collectibles. Why would one want these old computers?
So assuming that I ever finish my book, which I plan to someday, the why is actually one of the key topics. And I've thought a lot about this. So if you exclude nostalgia, there's still a couple really good reasons, Carrington, for owning these things. So here they are. One is, the older computers are simpler. If you're trying to learn about computers or electronics or the intersection of those two things, the older computers let you look at this from first principles. You can look at the thing and understand it, whereas if you look at a modern motherboard with its extreme miniaturization and really, you don't do component-level repair anymore. You do board-level repair or diagnosis these days. But you can actually get out your soldering iron with one of the old computers. So you want to learn how computers work. You want a working model that's simple enough to understand. A retro computer is a great place to start. Secondly, I don't know of any... Actually, I take that back. There's a couple of other categories of things, human artifacts, where I think that the history is better preserved by the lay people, or perhaps more prolifically preserved by the lay people than it is by actual museums or places that are typically tasked in our society to preserve this stuff. Definitely, computers fall into that category. You've got tons of people out there that have these old computers. They document them. They shove their scans up onto BitSavers. They restore them. They take them out places and demonstrate them. They're preserving history in a very hands-on way. And yes, there are museums that do that and official institutions that do that, but they're literally dwarfed by the enthusiasts that do that. So I think we're preserving history in a really tangible, visceral way. I think that's important. And so I think that's another good reason to own these things. So those are my 2 cents.
Nice ones. I like it. I like your thinking there. Those are very good. What about you, Paul? Anything to contribute?
Well, I guess, so one of the things that I would say about this is that technology advanced very quickly, right, in that sort of time period. And so, you know, it is useful to be able to sort of like look at these computers and grasp the entirety of them. But I think also the sort of the lifespan of at least some of them, was such that they haven't actually adequately been explored. They haven't been exhausted. There are more things that you can do with them. But the technology surpassed them, and then people sort of dumped them and went on to the new thing. So I think that there are, particularly with computers that didn't have a whole lot of a big sort of user base, there's a lot of stuff that you can still, there are puzzles to figure out. There's sort of intellectual tasks that you can do with them. This is one of the things that I think about with the Apple III, because there weren't that many people using it and it didn't last all that long, but there still are, I think, a lot of things that one could do on this machine that has never been done before. So I think that's one of the things that apart from what Earl said, that interests me.
Very good. I hadn't really even thought of taking that tack. So that's a really interesting idea. You know, that never even occurred to me, and it seems to chime true. I agree with what you're saying. It's funny that that's never even occurred to me before. So good one. Nice point. Michael, would you like to join the conversation? What have you got to say to justify your desires?
Well, that's just the point. Why do I have to justify what I do for a hobby? I see the point. Nostalgia's all well and good, but I like the older computers more from an aesthetic point of view, the different styles, the different approaches on their architectures. And then also, I also like looking at the different ways that the same Z80 or 6502 was used for different machines and how different they are. If you have a look at it today, you've seen one Intel powered PC, you've seen them all. But if you start playing with a Z80 based processors, there are so many different types of computers out there. And then you go across and there's, as you would know, so many different arcade games, which are also based off the Z80 processor as well. And it's just interesting to me to see the breadth of what was being done with the start of the microprocessor technology for computers, and it never ceases to amaze me. And really, I just like playing with them.
Very good point. And I do think that while this question does come up in all seriousness, I do think that we should examine even the idea that why should one have to justify it? There's a lot of hobbies out there where people collect some strange things. And it's fairly
stamps,
rare, I think, people... Yes,
yeah,
stamps.
Penguins.
Well, okay, sure, why not? Baseball cards, what have you. I wonder sometimes if there's any justification for even watching baseball. Send your baseball hate mail to me. But, like, rarely does it seem that somebody gets approached who is a collector of stamps, a collector of baseball cards, to say, why? Why would you have that? Some people might say, well, that's silly, you shouldn't spend your money on it, but it seems rare that the people who are collectors of those sorts of things are called to task. There's the one. That's a phrase. Called to task to say, you know, justify it. Why do you like those things? Because I get that quite a bit. I'll explain to my friends, I'll explain to new people I meet that I really like vintage computers. So I go to Kansas Best, and I like the 8-bit era of computers. And inevitably, it seems at some point, some form of the question why gets asked. And it's never really occurred to me to say, well, why would you ask me that? You wouldn't ask me that if I was into something else, if I was into old cars and I just like restoring them.
1960s, 1970 muscle cars, yeah.
Yeah, people would say, why would you want a car like that? Well, just inherently it is beautiful, inherently it's fun, and inherently it's something interesting to work on, and maybe I just like it. I do find, though, that I have been, you know, dozens of times in my life asked, in a sense, to justify the fact that I like these retro computers. So I've enjoyed all of your answers to this.
I really like Michael's observation that there's an aesthetic value to mm-hmm. these things. I mean, for instance, with you, Carrington, you at some point have indicated you would like to pick up an Atari. And while
the 800.
Yeah, while the 130XE Atari would do more and ostensibly could be found even in better condition, occasionally new in the box, one of the reasons you want the 800 specifically is the industrial engineering.
Exactly, and that industrial design is something right. that just is one of the most beautiful things ever, I think.
Yep, so it's just kind of nice to just look at these things, and it shows beauties in the eye of the beholder.
Mm-hmm. And just like old cars, it's pretty hard to justify desiring a 1960s or 70s muscle car if you just go based on capability. Modern cars will be faster. Modern cars will be better, quote-unquote, in just about every way. They will drive nicer. They will corner better. They will keep their value better. They will have air conditioning. They will have better shocks. They will cost less. You can insure them. All those things. But that doesn't mean that driving like a late 60s Mustang wouldn't be awesome. And I'm not even a car guy. So I get that. Anyway, I really liked all of your responses. And I'd love to hear from our listeners, because I'm sure people out there have had the same question posed to them, that they've been asked, well, why? Why are you into these things? Why would you listen to something like the RCR? Why would you collect ZX, you know, computers? Like, what's up with you, you Sinclair person? And you shouldn't have to justify it, and yet I'd still be interested in, are there other reasons out there? So, I mean, Earl talked about how they're simpler. You can learn from first principles. I also agree with that, and I think also sometimes simpler is just more fun. There's something really enjoyable about working on and programming and playing with a relatively simple machine, although, you know, it's still much more advanced than the wheel. Paul's idea of the, you know, that we haven't explored the full capabilities of a lot of these, so that all their capabilities haven't been realized. I think that's excellent. I think it was Earl, you said that preserving history in a hands-on way, also a great point. Michael's point about aesthetics and approaches and why do we have to justify it, like, all these are great. I suspect there's more, and I'd love to hear from our listeners if you've got another point or one of these to expand upon. So if you do, let's keep the conversation going, huh? Right in. Come on. We'd like to hear from you. You can send us email at feedback@rcrpodcast.com or just head over to rcrpodcast.com and you can check out the show notes and get in touch with us that way. That would be nice of you. We would like to hear from you. So let's talk about news. News fellows. There's been items of interest. And Earl, why don't you kick us off and talk to us about the Retro Challenge?
Why don't I? Because I think people should get involved in this. If you haven't already sent in an entry, then go. But maybe you're wondering, what's a retro challenge? It is a loosely organized, as they say, group of people who just do things for a fixed period of time with retro computers, and they document it on the blog. And then there's some prizes sometimes, but, I mean, basically it's just, it's one of the looser challenges or contests that I've ever seen, but it's a lot of fun. There's already some entries in there. They'd like to have more. We'll have the link, retrochallenge.net, up in our show notes. Some of what is already going on includes someone restoring a North Star Horizon, which, again, speaking of industrial design, I always thought that was a gorgeous machine. It's kind of boxy and a bit wooden, but just, you know, really interesting and indicative of the age. Another person is building a ROM monitor for their homebrew 6502 computer, which I think it's cool to just even have a homebrew 6502 computer.
Mm-hmm.
Yet another person is compiling a web server that'll run on the Mac 128. So who said you couldn't do exciting things with that 128K of memory?
I did. Oh, sorry.
Well, apparently a lot of other people did too, because the Mac didn't start selling well until they gave it more RAM. But RetroChallenge.net is where you want to go. Just do anything. But for the month of July, I should mention it runs during the month of July, and it's the Summer Challenge. There's two every year, one in the summer, one in the winter. And if you want to get in on the summer one, there's still time. So head on over there and sign up.
Nice.
Also, in news, there's no more details yet, but on August 9th, there's going to be what they're calling a vintage computer fair at the Living Computer Museum in Seattle. And apparently everything's still on, and they're still planning to do it. I'm just a little worried that no more details have emerged, because if they're going to have other people come in and do booths or displays or talks or anything like that, it's kind of running out of time for people to get their stuff together and get ready to do it. So I may try and contact them this coming week and see if I can squeeze some more details out of them and get them to push that out to the interested population. But if you are over here on the left coast and you would want to go to such a thing, we'll have a link for that event up on Facebook also. The Living Computer Museum in Skedaddle, Washington, headed up by none other than Mr. Paul Allen.
Very nice. Well, when you talked about that one retro challenge entry where somebody's doing something with the, you know, the 128 Max, reminded me of one of the things that really is limiting on the old Macs, on the original, and even on the Fat Mac, on the 512, is the fact that they only have the 400K floppies. And it's hard to make disk images of those. And again, that's a real limiting factor of those first two Mac models versus the Mac Plus and onward. And there's a great... I read an article a while ago, so I just tracked it down. I'll have it in the show notes, of how to set up a Linux Netatalk server that will communicate over the Apple Share Workstation protocol to those early Macs. And then that lets you essentially get those onto a server, get them basically online, and now you can move software over, you can get things on and off them. It really opens an entire world. So if you've been struggling with one of those first two Mac models and trying to figure out how the heck do I get things on and off them, this is another solution. So I'll make sure I have a link to that in the show notes.
Nice. I've seen Netatalk being used for... I think connecting to an Apple II before as well, like the workstation card.
Yeah, exactly. So the Apple Share workstation stuff, which used to kind of drive me crazy back in the day, has now become sometimes a very useful alternative when there's no other way to get these to communicate with some old computers. So speaking of you, Paul, who just spoke up, let's speak to you, Paul. And why don't you tell us about this Apple Crate?
Okay, well, so the guy's name is Michael J. Mahon. I don't know how you pronounce it. Mahon. He created some years ago the Apple Crate, which was basically I should have actually looked it up. I think it's 8 Apple IIe motherboards, all kind of like set up in parallel, connected through a network interface that I think ran on the game port. And so essentially, it was a little parallel machine made of 8 IIe motherboards, and then he, a little bit later, introduced the Apple Crate 2, which was, I think, 17 of them. And so it's actually kind of a neat setup. He's got they all are connected over some sort of a bus interface, and there's one of them is a sort of a controller, and the other one is a message server, and then messages get passed, and the only point of connection between any of these is this message pipeline. So it's a sort of loosely coupled parallel machine, and he's done a couple of interesting things with them. The thing that brings it into the news at this point is that he's now made a video on YouTube that where he's connected the Apple Crate 2 to the Apple Crate 1 to make a 25 machine Apple Crate.
This is a Beowulf cluster if I've ever heard of one.
It's pretty cool. But he gives a little demonstration of how, he runs a program where they sort of talk to each other, and you move the video plug from one to the other, and you can sort of, watch the progress of each of them. The message server has a little status display that says, sort of how many messages are in the queue and how efficient all the machines are at emptying their message, queue. So, anyway, it's really interesting to look at. Watching the video just makes you wonder, like, what else you could make this thing do. I mean, I think he's on his on the website dedicated to the Apple Crate 2. He's done some music stuff where each of the separate boards has generated some music that got mixed down, and that's kind of interesting. You could imagine it doing fractals. That's actually a fairly easily parallelizable task. But anyway, so it's a neat thing to see, at least. And, there's a lot of blinking lights and there's a lot of Apple IIe's.
Very cool. Yeah, we're also going to make sure we have a link to NataNet, which is the networking protocol thingy that Michael had put together and introduced as a... it showed, I think, with a Pong game running over them on two different computers at Kansas Fest a few years ago when I was there. It was really cool to see. He had two Apple IIs, and they were playing... There was a Pong game going on that would go back and forth between them. And so it was two different computers, two different monitors, and the ball would leave the one monitor and appear on the other monitor, and then it'd bounce back and appear on the first monitor again. Remarkable. You see, it's like, oh my goodness, you've networked them just using that cable. It's pretty, pretty cool. In fact, I picked up a couple of NataNet adapters and had a lot of fun playing around with getting two different old Apple IIs to talk to each other. So really, really fun stuff.
Yeah, I just think sort of where would computing have gone if something like this was actually done back when the Apple II was the machine of the day. Just apart from the fact it would have cost a fortune to get 25 of them stripped out of their cases and racked up the way that he has, but it is a very interesting application of that technology using the parallel loosely coupled messaging. It's very impressive, and it's. Also, again, it's a good way of using a simpler technology to demonstrate the potential and the power of parallel processing. So, hurrah to the old technology.
I agree. And speaking of old technology, I will take the next bit of news because I want to throw us back and show how retro a retro computer can be. And we're not talking 1980s now. We're talking roughly 2,000 years old. Some computers have been around a little longer than one might assume, if you're willing to stretch the definition of computer to include the anti-Kythera mechanism. So that is a series of... It's like a box with a bunch of gears, and it was found in the Antikythera wreck. I think I pronounced this right. I don't know. And that is a shipwreck that dates from 1st century BCE, but there was a device found on the shipwreck which seems to date from about a century before that. So we are talking seriously old. Unfortunately, it was made of bronze. And bronze, of course, corrodes like crazy. So it's mostly very, very corroded bunch of gears. But as far as anybody can tell, it was something used on a ship to calculate, like by turning the gears and setting everything. It's like a little manual computer, an analog computer, to calculate the setting of the sun and the movement of stars, etc., so that you could navigate with it. It was a little navigation computer. It was essentially a GPS for the year minus 200. So pretty cool thing. And so a submarine, this new wearable submarine that I would consider just like a diving suit, but it's essentially super high-tech. Think Iron Man for underwater. So it's a new diving suit that is essentially a suit that is a submarine you put on. It's heading down to try to hunt for more of this. And I thought it was a really neat thing. So if you're into the deep sea diving, it's a cool story. And if you're into very, very, very remarkably old technology, it's a cool story too. So we'll have links to this whole submarine hunt business and also links to the Antikythera mechanism. So if you're interested in old mechanisms and computers made of gears, again, computers in quotes, then you can check out the links. And also the Antikythera mechanism has been recreated in Lego. And as I put in the show notes, anything in Lego must be good. So of course we'll have to link to that as well. So have any of you guys heard of this mechanism before?
Yes.
No, what? Oh, go ahead. I was just curious what culture it came from.
Greek.
Ah.
I think
so too.
Yeah. No, I've seen it come up in the news over the years from when it was first found, and then when they were doing the X-ray scanning and other scanning so as to have a look inside that lovely lump of corroded bronze to actually see and to differentiate the different gears without actually pulling it apart. So not only is it a interesting example of a analog computing device, it also has a great backstory on how they're actually figuring out what it was consisted of, what the gearing is, the positioning, and it's quite an interesting story. And you know, if anyone wants to have a look at oceanographic archaeology, technology, computing, scanning, it is a great focus, I suppose, for so many different fields of research and technology. It's just something that always gets my interest when something new about it pops up in the news.
Me too, and I've always loved the whole approach that we've had, that essentially we found this thing that for nowadays is almost like alien technology. Not alien in advance, but alien as in, well, it's some sort of tech, but what the heck does it do? And then the amount of effort required in figuring out what a corroded bits of device left, what would be its purpose. I find that really interesting, and something in that really resonates with me. And I think it has something akin to what it's like when you find old things from the 80s. You find an old card and go, I wonder what this does. And if I put it on the computer, how would I hook it up? Or how would I get that software to work? How would I get this network to talk to that old computer? And I find all of that very interesting. And the Antikythera stuff is just sort of that on a grand scale. So I've always found it fascinating. So there.
So does this help the Ken Beck one?
It does. Everything does, yes.
Okay.
Yes, we'll
it's
still
regaining
its
status.
Yeah. We'll just keep putting it in quotes.
Exactly. Good point. So, Michael, how about you take the next one? Talk to us about, speaking of particularly old, surprisingly old things,
yep,
what's up with this first object-oriented programming being from 1965?
Well, the fact that it is from 1965 to start with, I had always thought that object-oriented languages were a lot more recent. You know,
I'm nodding my head, totally, yeah, me too.
At least from the 80s, but here we have an article, World's First Object-Oriented Program from October 1st, 1965. So basically, a program that's not quite as old as some of us, but still.
Older than me?
Yeah. Young whippersnappers.
I'm also object-oriented, though.
Well, as interesting as I found the article, I still haven't yet done any serious programming in an object-oriented language. I'm still more of your procedural type of guy, but call me old-fashioned. But no, it's just an interesting artifact from back then. There's some YouTube videos showing the similar code. And it's back in the days when programmers used to put their listings from their impact printers into nifty little folders, and we used to hang our listings up in various racks so that the documentation and the source code was all available.
Mm-hmm.
None of this source servers and things like that. Kids today, they're spoiled. Then again, they're probably... fair whack of them wouldn't know how to program themselves out of a wet paper bag anyway. But it's Basically, just again, it's just showing that the roots of modern day computing go a lot deeper than what a lot of people first would think, which again comes back to why are we into retro computers? I really do love finding how everything old is new again. So in this case, it even surprised me. I did not think that object-oriented programming was quite that old. And I just keep going through everything that comes up, and some days I am just so bright-eyed that I just can't believe the impact that our retro computing had. You think that things have evolved over time, but really, yeah, object-oriented programming, yeah, it's amazing. I'm blathering.
No, but I'm totally with you. For me, object-oriented programming is something that came about, I thought, long after I was already a developer, and it was something that I considered the new thing on the block. I resisted it for ages. I basically only got into it when I kind of had to for work, and then when I started doing things in C#, when I started using Objective-C, and I sort of got dragged into modern ways of programming. But for the longest time, I just was like, it's just a way to bloat your code. It's nonsense.
You were basically trying to avoid all this newfangled stuff, and it wasn't quite as newfangled as we thought.
Well, that's it exactly. So I am absolutely flabbergasted that there could be anything considered object-oriented, and this is actual object-oriented program from the 1960s. That's just crazy to me. Absolute news. I never would have guessed.
It's kind of interesting too. I went through and looked at the video, and the video. I think this must be sort of a treasured artifact or something, because we have these sort of snapshots, and the YouTube video is somebody like turning the pages of the thing, to sort of quickly get a scan of the code in a kind of like spy type way.
But that was how we had to review the code. I never reviewed code on the screen. I reviewed code. I made my first edits on the actual printouts. Mm-hmm. And to me, going back to the console or the terminal or my PC, that was basically my editing window, where I made the changes and then submitted the program to do what it had to do. But you know, to me, I just love sitting back watching the video of flipping through the pages, scanning the code, and it really brought back my early programming from the 80s. So mm-hmm. Yeah, I loved it.
And IDEs used to be so terrible.
We've mentioned this before, but the Doug Engelbart set of videos that's up on YouTube, the mother of all demos.
Yes.
Also from the 60s, and another one of those surprising things, I think, in parallel with this object-oriented programming being so old, the fact that you had a mouse and a graphical user interface and that kind of thing so long ago, too. If people haven't seen that, they should go see it on YouTube. The video quality isn't all that great, but that's probably the source video fault in this case, actually, rather than the rendering, because again, this was back from the 60s. But you see him sitting there with the mouse highlighting stuff, and like, whoa, that's from the 60s? No way. I mean, the video's even in black and white. It's so old.
They didn't have color yet.
Well, nothing did.
They'd upgrade their cards.
Everything was monochrome. I mean, they only invented color in the 70s.
And look what they did with it. Disco. My goodness. Shame on us. So, Earl, let's head back to you and talk to us about this Z80 pack. It's a Z80 simulator?
It's a set of software that does, and that's Z, Carrington, not Z.
I've never heard of it. What number is that?
Is that the 27th letter of the alphabet?
Okay, yes. I get it.
Yeah. Borrowed from the ancient Romans. That's right. This set of software is a simulator for the Z80 and 8080 chip now. They've recently added 8080 simulation to it to make some additional things work that didn't work before, which I think is cool. And I've played with it from back in the past, but didn't really notice at what point they added this cool 3D IMSCI emulator along with this set of software. So you set it up and you run it, and it's running CPM or whatever you'd like on the IMSI, but you've got a 3D rotatable model of an IMSI 8080 that you can flip the switches and watch the lights blink and single step through stuff. And if you can't afford an IMSI, and I'm definitely in that category, it's really fun to have a 3D model of the software, of the computer that you can play with. So I just thought I'd throw that out there and let people know. It's got a model of the Altair also. I think the Altair model is just a 2D front panel simulation. The IMSI, you can turn around, you can see the ports on the back, and you can see the fan. Now, one little weird gripe here, the fan isn't running. So I think that that IMSI 3D model is going to overheat.
Probably. That's part of being accurate.
That's right. How often would the fans break on those things? So if people are interested in that kind of thing, you should check it out. And you can have your own Play 3D IMSI that you can poke the switches with just like it was the 70s.
I love it if it overheated. I like emulators that have crazy levels of sort of real-world accuracy. I like the Virtual 2 emulator because it makes the sound of the disc being put in and grinding away. And it'd be fun if there was an Apple III emulator where you had to take the window and slam it to the bottom of the window of your computer to restart thing and reset it. So I think that this should overheat if the fan isn't... If you should have to spin the fan with your mouse or something. So.
Smoke coming out the back.
Well, actually, on the Apple III, with the motion sensors, inertia sensors in today's computer, I don't see why they can't actually hook that up into an Apple III emulator so that you lift the front of your laptop up and let it drop 3 inches to your desk just to reseat the virtual chip so you can keep running.
Try to explain that to the tech person. How'd you break your computer? Well, okay, I was working this emulator and I picked up my computer and intentionally dropped it hard. Really now?
Yes, my emulator crashed, so I threw my laptop to the ground.
And the emulator is working, but now the laptop's not.
Technology.
Ah, yes.
So I was going to say, I think the I actually tried to play. Earl, did you actually get this running? Because I about maybe like a month and a half ago, I took a shot at trying to install this and failed.
Oh. But...
I had a couple hiccups, but I did get it running, and the thing that did it for me specifically was to run the batch file called setup3d.bat under the IMSI sim directory. And that copied some files over or did some things. I don't know exactly what it did in the background. I didn't look at the batch file. But once I did that, then when I ran the IMSI simulator, it came up. And I hit the power button. The lights came on. I was like, ooh, that's so cool. And then actually, when programs are running, you see these simulated lights blinking on and off like you had a real IMSI.
Cool. Yeah, on the sort of accuracy of emulation, I think, as I recall, the Altair 8800 clone has some of that in it. You know, like the some of the weird behaviors and timing in the CPU are being emulated, even where they were sort of they weren't exactly up to the specifications.
I'd heard that the creator of that had really worked hard for as close as he could get to 100% accuracy. I think David was talking about that, because didn't David buy one of those?
I think so,
Altair clones? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is basically a big box with some electronics
right
on the front.
But still, you got the switches. You got the flippy switches. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. My daughter and I have talked about building some sort of a physical front panel and have just a back-end simulation, kind of like what this gentleman did with his Altair simulator. The only problem is, man, metal cases are really expensive. Metal project cases and that kind of thing. And the switches aren't cheap either. So you go to build one of these things and you just get soaked with the cost of the components.
It'd be cheaper to buy an LCD touchscreen and just display a graphic and then make the switches just literally as you just touch it and they switch. You could probably completely digitally emulate that front panel cheaper than
you could
make it out of metal.
You could. You could do it with an Android or a Windows 8 tablet or something like that. Sure. We wanted the real physical switches, man. We were going old school. Program that thing in binary like it was originally intended.
Yeah, I had I gotta admit, I had an Altair. It's like basically my first computer. And I've never missed it, to be honest. Like, there's the early computers I can do things with, like the Apple II. Then there's the early computers that were cool, but to be honest, no. So for me, retro only gets so retro before I'm just like, it's neat, but no thank you.
So no bronze gears for you, Carrington?
No, exactly. So everything between like 1976 and 2,000 years before that whole period, I'm basically less interested in. And then just slightly older than 2000, I get really interested again. But there's this one gap I'm less interested in.
That's a big period to exclude, Ben.
I lump it all together as old.
Yeah, really old. Then came the retro computer revolution, and then it got quiet and boring again.
That's pretty much how I feel. Like, I hate to say it, but that is really how I view these things. There's this one interesting period with big buffers of less interesting on either side of it.
I woke up for a couple decades, and then I went back to sleep.
It's kind of neat. I'm like, ah, you're just doing the same thing over and over again. I'm going to head back to the 80s.
But so speaking of that period, didn't you have some retro game goodness that was from that time?
I do indeed. I've got a trio of such little bits of news. Thanks for the throw there, Earl. So first of all, Lode Runner, one of the all-time great games, in particular the Apple II version, is the one true version. It is awesome. But that version has now been ported over to the Tandy Coco, another computer I had as a kid. Was never a huge fan of the keyboard, to be perfectly honest. Oh, the joys of a chiclet keyboard. But I think this is awesome. I love when something like this gets ported. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Very, very cool. Second little bit of retro gaming goodness. Their E3 recently happened, which is all modern stuff. I'm a little less interested in that, to be honest. But Alexei Pajnitov, I never know how to pronounce his name, but basically I think of him as the Russian Tetris guy. So Russian Tetris guy was interviewed at E3, which is kind of cool. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes so you can hear the interview. It's kind of neat because he still has such a great accent, and it's a bit moose and squirrel, but it's kind of cool. He's talking about what led to the development of Tetris and how interesting it was to see it everywhere. So really fun interview if you're interested in that. And we'll also have a link over to the BBC documentary from Tetris from Russia with Love. And then finally, the Sharp X68000. That is a computer I did not know about. So it's a computer made by Sharp, obviously, and it seems to be a Japanese exclusive model. But why it's in the news is there's been this one game that the collectors of this have known about and have been looking for ages, is this shoot 'em up called Illumination. And somebody was looking at the Sharp 68000 listings on eBay and thought, looking in the background of a computer for sale, I think that's that game. And so word spread and the industry got really excited about it. And it was very lucky that somebody who was in the community was able to pick this up and then release it rather than pick it up and say, aha, now I have it. Nobody else does. So there has been a long lost game, and it's nice that that's been found. And I was very surprised at the level of detail and graphics and speed you can get. But this seems to be a computer that was very much geared towards actual arcade game development back in the day. But what I liked about it was it introduced me to the Sharp X68000, which was a computer I had never even heard of before. Had any of you guys heard of that one before?
I can't remember exactly where I came across it, but I did. I briefly looked at it and discovered that there's just no way that I'm going to get one. If you look on eBay now to try to get them, actually there are a couple that are listed on eBay for like four figures and thousands of dollars, but the ones that have actually sold are a little bit more reasonable, still quite expensive, in the hundreds of dollars. But I know that it was not very well known on this in this part of the world.
I have seen one of these. Somebody brought one to a club meeting one time, and it was really amazing, and it was running some Japanese games on it, which kind of, to be honest, the Japanese writing on the screen is what caught my attention initially. But I walked up to the computer and was amazed. I mean, it didn't even look vaguely familiar, like anything I'd ever seen before. And it was fun to watch it go through some of its paces.
It's really cool. And so I started reading about the computer, and what's surprising about it is how incredibly powerful it is graphic-wise. I mean, it runs on a chip that's based on the Motorola 68K. Obviously, that's where it gets its name from. But even like the earliest model that came out in 1987 was something like 10 megahertz. And then eventually, it was, you know, within 4 or 5 years, it was up to 50 or 75 megahertz or something. So pretty powerful there. But even the initial one comes with 4 GPUs. I mean, it's just crazy. There's a sprite controller, and completely separate from that, there's a CRT controller, and there's like 2 video ones or something. It's like pretty remarkable because it's so geared towards sort of fast, high-end gaming and development for arcade games, like stand-up arcade games. So, I mean, so much more powerful gaming unit than anything I was playing with in 1987. So really a remarkable computer. So I'm not surprised that it's still popular and collectible. I'm just surprised I'd never even heard of it before. So there. So, Michael, what about you? Let's go back to you. I hear there's like a soccer thing going on that the rest of the world's interested in. Oh, yes, football, the real version of football. So what is up with old computers and football, etc.?
Well, while I was getting bored watching Australia get thrashed by the pool that we're in, the pool of death, as they called it, and rightly so, but that's for another podcast, I decided to... I didn't decide to. My mind started wandering, and my keyboard and web browser followed. And I basically came across this. It's all Portuguese to me as far as reading it, but there's a slideshow here. We'll have a link in the show notes. And it's showing computers, and I believe that the tag is that it's computers as they have been used through the various World Cups. So unfortunately, they're all behind glass. So lots of seeing, but no poking. I just thought it was sort of an interesting side to the football fiasco. The World Cup that's currently on.
It's fun to play spot the computer. It's like, okay, I recognize that one. I don't recognize that one. That looks like a calculator.
Yeah, I would really like to sort of see some more photos of this, and I'm trying to sort of find some links into, if there's a web page more than just this slideshow that's been posted up on Google+. But it was one of the more interesting things that I found when I was up at some early hour of the morning.
I wonder if these are all sort of Brazilian computers. I mean, you know, obviously the World Cup has moved around.
Yes, I was trying to sort of see if there were any of those lovely Brazilian clones of machines. Some very horrible looking devices came out of there because of the Brazilian government trying to promote their own IT industry by banning the importation of computers.
I remember we talked a few episodes ago, I guess, about that Brazilian copy of the Mac, early Macintosh that they displayed over a lake.
Yeah, it looks so ghastly with those PC-styled floppy drives awesome. Just clashing with the rip-off of the back case. Oh, well. To each their own, but I believe there is stuff out there apart from retro computing, but we'll have to wait another 4 years for Australia to make a show at it.
Well, good luck with that.
No, it's going to take more than luck.
But speaking of the World Cup, I thought I would use that as a segue into my host's retro computing gift idea. Every episode...
No, that's been done already. Hasn't someone already bought the next World Cup?
Apparently, yes, from everything I read, indeed. But I was thinking, if you're not going to buy somebody a World Cup, what else could you do? And I was thinking, what might be fun if you've got a fan of old computers, old gaming, etc., is you could either build for them, or better yet, build with them your own video soccer game. That is a Pong game, one of the early Pong ones that would come with soccer built in. There's a couple of ways you can do this, and we'll have links in the show notes, and one of the easiest would be to just pick up the TV game construction kit, which is sold at pongmuseum.com. So get over there, and it's just a do-it-yourself little kit. You assemble it, looks fairly straightforward, and bingo, you've got yourself a Pong game, including soccer and hockey and all of that. Perhaps a more fun way to go, and maybe the way that I think Earl would do this with a sibling, is to pick up the AY3 8500. That is the Pong on a chip. If you remember back in the day, back late 70s, suddenly there were Pong games everywhere. Everybody was making a Pong, and they were, you could barely differentiate them other than the case, and suddenly there's a million Pong games. Well, why was that? It was because there was Pong on a chip. In the same way that nowadays we have all these SIC, you got silicon on a chip, and then suddenly everybody can knock off the same sort of laptop. Well, that happened a few decades ago with Pong, when the AY3 8500 came out, and it was everything you need for Pong, all of it completely self-contained, on a single chip, and all you would need nowadays is to basically give it power, hook up the controllers to it, and it's a fairly straightforward system. The problem is getting it to talk to a modern display, so rather than something that uses an RF converter. So to do that, there's a couple of ways to go, and I have links in the show notes for both of those. And the easiest, though, there's a really nice, what I call DIY Pong but better instructions. There's a PDF from a site over at pong-picture-page.de, and you can download that, and that's the instructions on how to use an AY3 8500 to make your own Pong game, but have it spit out the video in something that's a little more modern. And just to round out the fun, we'll also have a link in the show notes to a bunch of vintage make-it-yourself Pong ads, because of course when the Pong on a chip came out, it made it really easy for people to not just put out self-contained store-bought Pong games, but also in the back of electronics magazines, lots of make-it-yourself Pong kits started to flood the market. And there's a nice site over at pong-story.com that has a link to a whole bunch of ads from that time, and they are just a delight to look through and see how people were trying to differentiate their kits. So all of that is my way of suggesting a very retro World Cup-themed retro computing gift or hobby that you could do with a loved one. So there you go. So, speaking of buying things, let's keep the shopping alive by heading over to eBay and see what each of us have come up with for people to purchase each other, or perhaps for just to purchase for yourself, or sometimes something that we intend to snag and hope that we get to it before our listeners do. So Earl, why don't we start with you? What have you selected for you or others to buy this week?
Well, paper tape. And it could be kind of boring, but in a sense, I think it is potentially really interesting because it appears to be, from back in the day, the game Star Trek, or with the 6-character file name, as was wanting back in those old days of ye olde, STRTRK. So Star Trek. So, who needs vowels? Vowels are for wimps. So we've got this paper tape, and I've seen paper tapes being sold on eBay and other places, but in a lot of cases, they're reproductions. Somebody's got a paper tape punch, maybe on an old ASR33 teletype, and they run some paper tape through it, and then they sell them, and that's nice. It's a curiosity. This one looks like it's aged, so unless somebody artificially aged it, it looks like this is an actual paper tape from back in the day. A roll of paper tape playing the extremely well-known Star Trek game that was famous and put on so many different platforms, ported to so many different computers. So the seller here seems to think it's IMSI Altair CPM Z80 something or other, doesn't seem to really know.
That's how it was actually advertised back in the day.
Which computer this goes for, and who knows whether this is a paper tape with assembly code or if it's written in BASIC or whatever. Don't know, but it looks cool.
It kind of makes it all the more fun, actually.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mystery, and in my collection for storage stuff, I've got some punch cards, nine-track tape reel, an old 8-inch floppy disk. It's kind of fun to show people this is the way that we used to store data in these different mediums. I don't have any paper tape, and I wish that I'd have kept some of my paper tape from back in the like late 70s, early 80s when I actually worked on an ASR33 teletype. We couldn't get much time on the computer downtown, so we'd punch our programs ahead of time onto paper tape, then dial up with the cradle the modem and roll them in that way. And I wish I'd have kept some of that. So anyway, I was looking at this, and I was like, that makes me feel nostalgic. So that's my pick.
Nice one. What about you, Paul? What have you got for us?
I have an arbitrary auction. As I was looking through what there was, I have some sort of gravity attraction that I have to Commodore SX64s and you know, Aquarius systems, and you know, I keep picking the same things all the time. I guess maybe I've picked one of these before too, but the auction that I've picked is it says vintage 1983 Tandy Paladin personal computer. And what it is, I mean, if you look at the picture of it, it's a Tandy 102, except it's labeled Paladin MC1 and has this big box on it. And I dug around, and it's basically like a rebranded Tandy 102, and it was, I guess, from a little bit that I've seen online, it was used as a kind of a blueprint measurement, reproduction system. It had a sort of specialized purpose, and I don't really know what this box does. But I think so. The reason I picked it was just because it seemed like it might be interesting to just explore this. It's probably basically just a Tandy 102, probably with a specialized ROM in the ROM socket. And it's a mystery. I think the company may actually still exist, but obviously, it's unlikely that you would find someone who would really still know how to do this. So, anyway, it's listed at 105 105 U.S. dollars. Does it ship? It ships all over the place, and they do take offers. Because I would probably suggest offering. Anyway, that's it.
Nice. I wonder, it says it has two microphones in the front, which is also kind of interesting, because I don't think the 102 does normally have that. I don't know. I wish, that's one of those computers I've always wanted to have, is a Tandy 100 or a 102, as my personal, modern portable computers have become lighter and more capable, especially basically with the existence of the iPhone, kind of killed a lot of my love for old luggable computers, unfortunately. And they so don't have anything to do with each other, so I don't know why that is, but it seems to be that's what's happened for me. But I still love the Tandy 100 form factor. I still think it's super cool. I don't think they're supposed to have two mics on the front, so I wonder why that change as well. Fascinating.
Yeah, I didn't actually see. It's possible that that's a misdescription. Let's see.
They're not showing a picture of the front, so I want to see it.
Yeah.
Maybe it's two mic inputs for an early podcast.
I think. I wonder if they're just talking about the DIN connectors for the phone and cassette on the back. That maybe they
perhaps.
It's possible this person thought they looked like a microphone input.
Interesting.
Anyway,
that's fine.
Yeah, it might be interesting to explore.
Cool. Well, for my choice, we talked earlier in the episode about how the original Toaster Macs, the original Mac and then the Fat Mac, have some limiting factors that make them a little more difficult to work with than the later Toaster Macs, particularly the floppy drive. So I'm going to jump forward, and I am going to suggest a listing for a Macintosh SE30, which I think is one of the probably five best computers Apple has ever made. I think it is heads and tails above all the other Toaster Macs, including the models that came after it, like the Classic and the Color Classic and the Classic 2. All of those pale in comparison to the wonderful, unbelievably soup-upable Macintosh SE30. And there's a nice one on eBay at the moment. It's going for, I think it was almost $500, which is expensive. But we talked at the beginning of the show how one does not have to justify one's love for these things. You just have to bite the bullet and purchase them. And I like this because it's a clean version, has a bit of yellowing in the back. The Toaster Macs, including the SC30, often are quite yellowed when you see them. This one just seems to be a little bit in the back, but it's really clean. Keyboard's not in great shape, but it does come with the external CD-ROM drive, and so that's nice and fun. It's a really terrific computer, and it's one of the best ones, and it's a nice version of one. They come up quite a bit. They're not rare, but it's hard to find one in really nice kit. So here's one. I love it. And it gives me a chance to link to a couple of other things as well. Recently, there's been a 2SI Color Pivot 2 card hack. So the Color Pivot 2 was a video card for the 2SI. And speaking of computers that I think are some of Apple's all-time best ones, the 2SI would never make that list for anybody as one of the all-time stinkers. But it could take the Color Pivot 2 card, and there's been a hack recently because that's a PDS card, and the SC30 has a PDS slot. I think there's better things you can do with it, but you can now get a Color Pivot 2 into it, and that would give you a big external color monitor you can run from your SC30. Oh, as Michael would say in our chat, all hail the SC30. I do love that computer. And I'm also going to link to one of those long Torx bits. You can pick it up for $5 on eBay right now. Somebody's selling a whole bunch of them. The Toaster Macs have those odd Torx screws, or as I think some American call them, Torx. I recently heard somebody pronounce it that way. Up here in Canada, we say Torx. And it's under the handle, so it's hard to get a screwdriver in there. I used to take a screwdriver and file away the edge so it could reach. Much, much easier to get one of these long Torx bits, and you can pick them up from $5. If you need to crack open one of these Toaster Mac cases, that's the way to get at the guts. So that's what I'm going to select, a Macintosh SE30. Michael, what about you? What have you got to round out our eBay selections?
Well, just a bumper sticker. So it's a 1981 I Love My Apple. Now, they say it's for, in the listing, my Apple Macintosh, but I believe the sticker is from 1981, so it's a little pre-Macintosh-y. But still, I like seeing the different ones that are out and about. I've picked up a few different stickers over time. I'm probably will not participate in this one because $5 opening bid. But again, I'm not going to shell out $41.50 to have it mailed over to me. I don't think it's quite important enough for that one to go into my collection.
It's from Portland, though. Maybe Earl could pick it up for you and then just stick it in the post.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. That's very lateral, very lateral of you there, Carrington.
I'm lateraling over to Earl.
I'd be happy to. That's amazing that they would want to charge $41. That must be an automated calculation. I mean,
it is Priority Mail International.
Oh, well, then, fully justified.
Then there you go.
For $41.50, I want the planet stopped so the plane can actually get here faster, or at least spun in a different direction so that...
That's all that really is, Priority Mail to Australia. They put it in a little balloon, it goes straight up. It hovers, the Earth rotates, they pop the balloon, it drops on you. It takes 12 hours to deliver.
Ah, there we are. Isn't technology wonderful, eh?
Nothing should take more than 12 hours to get to the other side of the world. If you could just stay still, that's how long it takes.
No, but I've mainly picked up Apple and other computing stickers that are in Australia, have a bit of an Australian bent to them. But I don't know if I'd put this on my car, but definitely would get framed and hung up in the bunker. But just something different, just a little bit of art for the house.
I like how it's copyright soft key. Although they put the Apple trademark on it, they're like, "Yeah, we're just using your trademark. Yep. We're making the bumper sticker." Yep. There you go.
Yeah, we'll pretend we're playing nice.
I was thinking about that too. Fairly sure this is not anything official. The colors in the Apple are all sort of blended together at the seams and things. It's a very un-Jobs-like.
Nice, so very cool. Nice. Excellent. Well, that is then a handful of things that one could buy somebody that they like over on eBay or purchase for yourself, which may be the way that I might go for it. So let's wrap up the show and see if there's anything people have of interest they might want to share. I see Paul typing live. Is that your hand raised there, Paul, in our show notes? What have you just typed in there, the MTU 130? What is that?
It is. So You may recall that on the last episode, I talked about an eBay auction which was going to end before the episode actually got out. There was the MTU 130, and I got it, as it turns out. So it is, you can review the last episode, but it's a 6502 based machine. Fairly powerful graphics and sound capability. So I got it. It arrived. It turned out, actually, this thing is huge. I did not understand quite how big this was. In the picture, what I thought was a 9-inch monitor turned out actually to be like a 12-inch monitor. It's a massive thing. It doesn't work, but I'm sort of interested to. So I reached out to the company. And have heard nothing back, so I may have to actually call. But I went as far as to open it up and take pictures of the stuff inside, and it's got kind of an interesting design. This sort of strange tiered, the cards are all sideways inside, and I plugged it in, and I can see sort of like nice high resolution, error bars on the screen. But it's not static, but I think it's going to require quite a lot of troubleshooting. I know that this when it was new, when it was actually a system, had a disk drive. And in fact, actually, I think there was a sort of something special about the disk drive. I think it was always running, which is a strange property of it. But it would.
Bet it's not running anymore.
Yeah, well, it does seem like that's a sort of short-sighted, but at any rate, it would always run, and then the head would move, down to it when it needed to read data or something like this. I'm not sure, but at any rate, I have no disk drive, so it's going to be an uphill climb, and it's going to take a lot of space while I climb that hill. But anyway, I got it. It's so hopefully in the future I will document it. It's possible that would be my retro challenge, to just try to make it cool. Do something.
Speaking of documenting it, people should follow you on Twitter, because I remember it was not too long ago, a few days ago, you posted a couple of pictures of this thing, one of which with the hood up, and holy cow, that's awesome looking. Like, it's just in the same way that the Pet looks amazing. Like, the computers where you can sort of open them up like a car bonnet. Just fantastic. So, yeah, great, great photo.
Yeah. That's my news.
It's my way of saying people should follow you. You have neat photos.
Thanks.
So for me, I'm going to share a really cool thing I did last night, which is not really, I could try to find some way that it's related to retro computers, but I don't know, but I was still buzzing from how cool it was. So people who like adventure games, yeah, that's what it would be. So in Toronto, there are 7 or 8 places that you can go that do real life room escape games. You get locked in a room and it's filled with puzzles, and you have to sort of, it's like those room escape games you might play on a laptop or on an iPad or something, but you play them in real life. So some friends and I went and checked one out last night. It was my first time doing it. I'm already hooked. It was amazing. So we had been locked in a Mayan temple, and we had to solve a bunch of things. There's stuff on the walls. You have to find these little discs, insert them the right way, decode a symbol that gives you a number. You can try to padlock it over. You go to the next room, and it's basically a little maze. You have to solve all these real-world things. We had to turn on a little water pump to get a key floating. Like, there's a ton of stuff, a whole mathematical system we had to work out. It was amazing and super fun. So I did that last night.
And only half your party was eaten by grues.
Yes, exactly. We even have these little torches that you get when you first in these. And so you're in the dark, but just with these little plastic torches that do not give enough light, but that just adds to it. And there's music, and there are sound clues, and it was just an unbelievably cool experience. So I'll link to that in the show notes in case there are other people who live in Toronto and would find that kind of thing fun, because holy cow, it was awesome. So I did that last night. I loved it.
That would be amazing fun, but it can't be cheap.
It was, I think, $17.
That's actually pretty cheap.
Yeah, totally. It was rich.
Wow. Holy cow. Okay. Yeah. I'm on my way.
Yeah, there's a bunch of them. We just picked this one, and I think there's at least 7 different companies that do this in the greater Toronto area. So Toronto has become a great place to go if you want to get yourself locked in a room and get a ticking clock and see if you can solve puzzles and escape a real-world escape game maze. And it was unbelievably fun. So I'm already hooked, and I will be going to all of these places and doing all of the games. So I had a great time.
Yeah. Enter the retro game.
Yeah, it was, anyway, it was super fun. So I liked it. Michael, what about you? What have you got to wrap up the show with?
Not much. Like Earl, I've popped off my 2014 Summer Challenge entry. So I'm dusting off my one from the Winter Challenge. So a little bit of retro recycling. So I'll see if I can get my programming one done this time. So, Earl?
Hi.
I'm with you.
Yes, I was just trying to remember what it was you were doing, but this was the trying to get the thing to compile itself, right?
Yes. Well, not really compile. It's an AppleSoft code generator, but uses a form of BASIC, no line numbers. It's labels. I want to add some extra functionality into it. Long variable names. Procedures having parameters passed to them and then returning a result. So
and it can now pass the Turing test.
Well, why not? The human can fail it. So no, so we'll see how I go. It's just a little bit of a programming exercise.
Cool.
Anyone apart from Earl joining in? Paul, or you're having too much fun playing with all your new toys, aren't you?
Your surprisingly large computer.
Yes. Well, I think I may turn the MTU-130 into a retro challenge project. I keep trying to do these similar things, and the retro challenge every single time it's exactly the same. I have this nice idea, and then suddenly there's a week left, and then it's over. So, we'll see what happens this time.
It's hard to find time. I agree.
Well, and there you are. Retro challenge. Make time.
Make time. So, Earl, what about you? Things great in Earl Land?
They're pretty darn good. And better than some, not as good as others. I will say, though, that I'll cheer on Michael. We can cheer each other on this retro challenge thing and hope to get Paul interested in it, too. We can all get in there and rig the contest. But the thing that I'm doing, I'm programming three different games in three different languages on three different computers. The games are pretty simple, well-established rules, 21 craps and roulette. And on the Epson PX8, I'm going to do it in BASIC. On the Atari, I'm doing it in fourth. And on the PDP-11, I haven't quite picked yet. I was going to do it in BASIC on the PDP-11, but BASIC's easier on the PX8 because you can do it on the machine. If I use something else, I might have to cross-develop the thing, and that just sounded like too much work. It's over the top. So I might actually do it in Fortran on the PDP. That was one of the first languages that I learned on the PDP-11. So
Yeah, same here. Go for Fortran. I vote Fortran.
I vote Fortran,
okay.
Too.
Fortran it is. So I think that it's doable because the games themselves are really pretty simple. I'm not going for the full-blown, like with roulette, you know, there's a million different things you can bet on, and some of it gets so complex I don't even understand it. I'm not going to do all that stuff.
You're going to make a 3D rotating wheel graphic?
Well, there will be a wheel, and something will be moving.
Got it, okay.
But in terms of how animated it is, that's partially going to depend on the platform. I'm not sure how I animate it on the VT100.
And you're doing three games on three computers. Are you doing all three games on all three computers or one each?
So all three on all three.
Wow.
Equals nine equals, wow, I totally succeeded. If I get one game done on one platform, it's like I barely eked over the finish line. And like I said in my entry, no games on no platforms means epic fail, plus there's probably some smoking capacitors somewhere.
Got it. Okay, so your plan is to do some games on some platforms.
Right, and
hopefully it'll
add up to nine. And hopefully. That's my deal.
This makes me think, I think what I would like to see sometime is a roulette game on a large old tape drive. I mean, you could actually physically spin the thing, right?
Oh, that would be great.
I would like to see someone take Michael Mahan's NataNet and do one where it's a giant collection of Apple IIs all together in a big circle, and you just see the ball go around the monitor. That's the way you should do it. It takes 32 different Apple IIs to play this game.
So, a little bit of a funny story. I, of course, as a junior high student, would never have snuck over to the college nearby my house when I was a kid and onto their computer system. But hypothetically, let's say that I had. then one of the things that you would not wanted to have done is write a craps game and then sit there playing it on the computer and have everybody in the computer lab crowd around you, cheering you on while you're playing the craps game, leading the system manager to think there's something going on over here. Oh, it's that sneaky little junior high kid that I have to kick off the computer again. Yep. So if that's you, never do that. Just hypothetically speaking, sage advice.
Never get caught doing it.
Yes, never get exactly. caught doing that is Earl's message to our listeners. Nice. Well done, Earl. Cool. Well done, everybody. Good show. And thanks to you, dear listener, for being our dear listener. We really appreciate it and that you spent the time with us today to discuss these things. And remember, we're looking for feedback on how you justify, not that you need to, why you like retro computers beyond just nostalgia. Send an email. You can find the show notes for this episode, and in fact, for all episodes, over at rcrpodcast.com. There's links there to a forum. You can follow us on Twitter. We are at rcrpodcast. You can send us email. Of course, there's email links on the website, or you can just fire it off to feedback at rcrpodcast.com. We are a proud, hand-over-heart, proud member of the Throwback Network over at throwbacknetwork.com. Please review us on iTunes. 5 stars helps other people find us, and it makes the community bigger, and bigger communities are more powerful, and we can crush others below our feet. But that said, until next time,
Retro Compute.